You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations. Imagine your average Bigfoot encounter, as you've likely seen or heard from witnesses on TV or radio. You're in rural America, perhaps near a swamp or shadowy mountains. There are noises that you don't recognize. And then you see a large ape-like humanoid walk through your field of vision and back into the wild, likely to never be seen again. Glimpses of a rare but natural creature, right? Well, if you've been listening to Monster Talk for a while, you've probably heard us hint that there's often stuff getting left out of these stories. We've certainly discussed rock throwing, but have you ever thought about how much that sounds like poltergeists? Or how about footprints that begin nowhere in particular and then end in the middle of a mud patch or in snow? Or how about a Bigfoot accompanied by tiny hairy people? Little feet? Goblins? Or ghostly figures in white accompanying or preceding the appearance of Bigfoot? Or glowing orbs? Or eyes that literally shoot out beams of light? Or teleports? Or apportations? Or UFOs? There's so much weirdness around this stuff that my friend Jeb Card calls Bigfoot hunting forest seances.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. Karen and I have managed to get several episodes recorded about ghosts and paranormal topics and other monster-adjacent stuff, but I wanted to throw this episode ahead of those and get out something absolutely on brand for us in the monster category. There's been a concerted effort in cryptozoology, whether intentional or not, to sand off these unusual, unnatural, quasi-paranormal features to help Bigfoot seem more like a real flesh-and-blood creature. On this episode of Monster Talk, we're going to dive into the paranormal aspects of Bigfoot with authors Joshua Kuchin and Timothy Renner. Their two-volume look at paranormal aspects of Bigfoot is chock-full of what I'm tempted to call weird Bigfoot stories, yet what they make a very strong case for is that these may be weird in the not mundane physics and biology sense, but they're not even remotely atypical for the kind of features common to many Bigfoot stories. We don't even come close to touching on the variety of unusual features covered in these two books. So if the topic of paranormal Bigfoot is interesting to you at all, I think you'll find both of these volumes essential for your monster library. All right, let's get to the
Monster Talk.
Okay, tonight we're talking with Joshua Cutchin and Timothy Renner, and they are the co-authors of Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomena, Volume 1, The Folklore, and Volume 2, The Evidence. Joshua is the author of several books covering weird topics, including cryptozoological, Fortean, and UFOs, and fairies. And these books include A Trojan Feast, The Brimstone Deceit, and Thieves in the Night. And apparently he lives literally a rock throw away from my hometown of Kennesaw. And we've also got Timothy Renner, who's an illustrator, an author, and a musician who lives in Pennsylvania. And his work can be found in books, magazines, comics, and on album covers. He's a podcaster, the creator of Strange Familiars, and he has frequently appeared on Where Did the Road Go? And his books include Beyond the Seventh Gate, Bigfoot in Pennsylvania, Bigfoot West Coast Wild Man, Don't Look Behind You, and Apparitions, Illustrations of the Other. And we'll have links to all those in the show notes. Welcome to Monster Talk.
Thank you for having us. Great to be here.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I do live just a stone's throw away from you, and up until recently have been in Kennesaw like 5 days a week.
Wow.
So, yeah, I've been circling you like a shark, I guess.
I thought
like
I
the shark
something.
Circles its prey.
I saw some glowing eyes. Was that you?
Yeah.
So I am really excited to talk to you guys because, you know, we've been doing this show for more than a decade now, and
too long.
I hope it hasn't been too long, but I mean, yeah. Even so, I mean, we went from being pure. Is that real? Kind of skeptics too. I think I've really started thinking more along the folklore, the psychology, the sociology, the anthropology,
the culture, and
everything. Yeah, all the cultural impact of this stuff. It's so much more interesting and diverse than just is Bigfoot real or not. And I suspect we're probably in different places as far as belief in some aspects of this stuff goes, but I think we share the same deep enthusiasm for these topics and these stories. So I'm really excited about talking about this.
Sorry. I think he's trying to ask if you guys are skeptics or believers or something in between.
I am absolutely a believer, but I end up arguing from the skeptic position often because I do not believe it's an ape in the woods. It's something we can put in a cage. I don't think it's that simple. So I end up arguing with these apers a lot about, I end up taking the skeptic position. the skeptic position. I say I put on the skeptic's hat and it doesn't fit very well, but they kind of force me to wear it sometimes.
I mean, yeah, I resonate with a lot of what Tim said. It's probably why we ended up being able to write a book together.
Nice. Yeah.
You know, I was talking with Mike Cleland the other night, the owl guy, the owl UFO guy. And I was saying, you know, sometimes at the end of the day, you know, I think that people like me who are attracted to this field are people who really enjoyed like literary criticism, but never had the stomach to say something new about like some of these great novels, because what I really dig is like you alluded to, the psychological aspect of it. I mean, that, especially with like stuff like UFOs, there's so much symbolism that just is dripping off these encounters that even if they're completely, you know, quote unquote in someone's head, there's still interesting stuff to be mined there. Now, you know, I kind of think that these things are from your head, but not in your head, is where I sort of fall on things. But yeah, like Tim, we sort of end up arguing from the skeptical standpoint. Same with, you know, not only apers, but also people who believe that UFOs are aliens. I'm definitely kind of in the anti-extraterrestrial hypothesis camp on that one.
So where do you fall? I mean, you've written about fairies and fairy lore as well. I haven't had a chance to read those books. So where do you fall on that? Are you? I guess what I'm wondering is, like, I think a lot of people look at like Jacques Vallée's work and they don't actually read it, but they just think, oh, Jacques Vallée, he thinks UFOs are like fairies, therefore UFOs explain fairies, and then that's not what he's saying. I think it's the other way around. He's saying, you know, maybe it's more fairies might explain UFOs, you know, or fairies might explain aliens. I think this really easily misunderstood work, and I wonder where you how you fall in that whole sort of field.
Yeah, I don't think either are correct. I think both are trying to grasp at something that has an objective, real exteriority to the human condition. But neither system of belief, neither body of folklore is really 100% accurate in what it's describing. And, you know, by that I mean, you know, I don't like to admit it, but sometimes I wonder if this stuff doesn't come from us in some way as well. But, you know, to be intellectually honest, you kind of have to admit that maybe that's a possibility.
I had the opportunity to go to a monster conference in Texas in 2019, and it was put on by the religious studies group at the University of Texas in San Marcos. And we were there talking about all kinds of monsters, and I thought it was really interesting because there was a whole lot of talks that sort of dealt with the role of Yeti in Buddhism. But one of the questions that kept coming off, like outside of the actual talks, but like just around the tables and stuff, which is where the real magic happens at these conferences, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
The question was, in what way, I questioned, is Bigfoot a religion? And then I think the question that was put back to me is, well, what is a religion, first of all? But like, how is Bigfoot not a religion was even a more interesting question. Because, I mean, outside of the question of this, like, literally, do you worship Bigfoot? There's so much about the belief system, the sort of religious experiences, the sort of communion with nature when you go out to look for Bigfoot, and these sort of the offerings, and there's so many aspects of it that feel like a religion, and you can, I think, study the field from a religious perspective. Not, again, not talking about going to church or, you know, having a religious book, but just in this sort of sociological sense of how people practice their interaction with this, what is effectively a faith-based, unprovable concept. I loved it. It was really interesting.
Need a church of Bigfoot, I guess.
Well,
absolutely. I don't want to hog the mic, so I'll let Tim comment here. But, these things can fill that sort of religion-shaped hole in some people's hearts, for absolutely sure.
I think it's a matter of trying to decide do you study cults the same as you study religion? Because it's definitely a cult. I mean, no doubt about that.
Interesting. Yeah. And I guess you can. Certainly, it's just yet another lens you can put on it, I think. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And depending on, I mean, there's even different factions, right? There's different, you know, warring cults within, under the umbrella of the general, you know, cult of Bigfoot, that's, when you said this conference was put on by religious studies, I honestly thought you were making a joke about a certain organization in the South when you said that, because I thought that's where you were going with it, because they're so, you know, devoted and sure of their ideas as regards to these things, which, you know, nothing being proven and no one having captured one. I don't know how you can be, but more power to them. That said, there are cult-like aspects. I think Josh is going to some extent to point out how there's more of that with the UFOs, and we kind of struggle to find those sort of now they do happen. You do have those sort of life-changing moments when people have encounters and they you know become more environmentally conscious and so forth, like the UFO contactee experience. But they're far less with Bigfoot encounters than they are with UFO encounters. But, it's certainly there. Certainly the gifting thing, when people start the gifting exchange, I mean, that maps almost perfectly onto, you know, spirit gifting. If you read that into folklore, I've written some about that. It's almost like a one-to-one thing. It's to my mind, when you're gifting with, you know, quote unquote Bigfoot, what you're doing is spirit gifting, and to my mind, almost certainly. It's too much the same there. So, there's a lot of aspects of it that kind of at least lock into religion. I don't know if it's fair to call them a cult or to call it a religion, but there's certainly aspects of it that you know, kind of, you know, go step by step with that.
Maybe for some it's certainly a cult. But you talked about gifting. Could you just explain a bit more about what that is?
Yeah. So many Bigfoot witnesses or those who claim to encounter Bigfoot, maybe they don't even see him sometimes, but they enter into these gifting exchanges where they will leave something, often it's food, but not always, in an area for Bigfoot. And Bigfoot, they believe, something, leave something for them in exchange. And these long-term exchanges go on, and it's fairly effective. I mean, a lot of people have really, really good luck with it. You know, whether they're exchanging with Bigfoot or whether something else is going on, you know, it's hard to say. I don't think anyone's actually seen, you know, Bigfoot leave the gift there, except maybe for, I think the Mike Green video shows Bigfoot, you know, leaving something at the stump, presumably that he was doing a long-term gifting exchange with. But other than that, I don't think a lot of people have actually seen Bigfoot leave these things. It's just, you know, it's assumed. But they do get results, and it's very, very interesting. But, you know, people have been spirit gifting for ages. I mean, the simplest one to point out is leaving cookies and milk for Santa Claus. That's, you know, that's everybody does it on, well, not everybody, but, you know, most people who believe in
the faithful, the faithful do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, and you mentioned, you know, is Bigfootery a religion? There is actually a really cool chap who sent me a book that he did on sociological studies in amongst paranormal believers, quote unquote. And there are some really interesting, some interesting correlations that he finds between some of these things. But the one that he found in Bigfootery, I'm going to keep on using that word, Bigfootery, was that they tend to be really conventional people with one exception. And that's that less than half of American Bigfoot conference attendees identify as Protestant, which is lower than the national average, and attend church less frequently than the national average. So I think that all these things do have a metaphysical component to them, whether people realize it or not. I mean, I think even people who identify as religious in other aspects kind of get drawn into that a little bit, because what you're really doing is if you're doing it right, you're trying to figure out the way that the reality works, I think.
I agree. Although I would have to say, as a religion, you could at least get in the pulpit and say, can I get an ape man? Okay, sorry.
You know, there is a strong current of people in the Bigfoot community who, I don't want to quite say are sort of evangelicals, but there is a vocal group that say, oh, Bigfoot are the Nephilim, and they've tied into, you know, all these other pre-flood myths, and they've tied it into those sort of fallen angel categories, and that's why the, you know, Bigfoot are able to do all these strange things.
And Mormon folklore. Yep, yep.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So I thought, I know for some of our audience, this is going to be a big surprise because I, you know, having probably not read this kind of stuff before, it's real easy to read into cryptozoology and look into it and exclude this weird stuff. And I think what your books do is a fantastic job of collecting the stuff that's frequently excluded, probably on purpose, from a lot of the cryptozoological stuff.
Yeah,
I ran into this. I think last summer I was doing some work on the Ape Canyon case and went back and read Fred Beck's actual book that he put out about, and I was absolutely shocked.
Yep.
To find all this spiritualism stuff and all this weird stuff in there that I'd never seen portrayed in a documentary or written about in any other of the books. And so, and then to find it in your stuff as well was really, I was so happy that somebody else knew about this. Can you introduce our audience to the Ape Canyon story? I think most people have at least heard of it, but I mean, could you introduce it as it's usually told and then talk about what's left out? I think that'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Ape Canyon story, as I knew it before writing Where the Footprints End, Volume 1, was a group of miners were in the mountains in Washington State, and they started seeing some Bigfoot creatures, and a guy shot at one, and a group of Bigfoot creatures came to their cabin that night and harassed them all night long, you know, banged on the walls and climbed on the roof and attacked the cabin and threw rocks at it and so forth. And that's basically the story I heard. And it sounds like this great Bigfoot encounter like so many other Bigfoot encounters, maybe a little more intense. And but in general, it's nothing out of the ordinary as far as if you want to believe that they're just creatures. And I think Josh found Fred Beck's book for me and said, and just pointed me to it, said, hey, you need to check this out. And I start reading it, and I was like, well, this is nothing that's been presented. So this case appears in Bigfoot literature again and again and again over the years. It's one of these kind of hallmark cases. people point to it again and again, and never is this stuff pointed out. Never, never, never. But Fred Beck, who was there, and if we're not going to trust the people who are there, I don't know who you can trust. You know, you're going to trust some newspaper articles that were written, you know, at the time more than the guy who was there. I mean, this guy was there. And he's saying it all started when they saw what he called the ghost or the spirit of a giant Native American. Now, what does he mean by giant? I don't know. He doesn't really clarify. One would assume not a Bigfoot. One would assume he was looking at a giant Native American. And this Native American told them to follow a white arrow through the sky into the wilderness up there. So they did. So now they're following something that's in the sky. They're following something through the sky, which, you know, if that doesn't sound, you know, ring any UFO bells for you, I don't know what else you need. Along the way, they meet what they called another spirit. Now, how they knew she was a ghost or a spirit and not a normal person, again, he doesn't clarify, but he says they meet this other spirit named Vander White. And I don't think she turned letters for a living. I don't think that was on the air yet. But but Vander White, I think she tells them where to find the mine. And they find this gold mine. They're basically directed to this gold mine by this arrow and by this other spirit. And she meant so much to them that they actually named the mine the Vander White Mine. They get there and they start hearing strange sounds coming from the ground, like, you know, huge machinery and so forth. One day they find two or three footprints, I forget what it was, in the middle of an acre-wide sandbar. So no footprints leading up to them, no footprints leading away from them, just two or three footprints. And they said it looked like something picked up whatever it was and dropped it in the sandbar and then picked it up again and flew away with it. And, you know, all manner of weird things are happening. I think he had an apport of a pencil. He said he knew the pencil was at his house and he needed a pencil and it just appeared in his hand. So these weird poltergeist-like things are happening. And eventually they see the creature, and then the story plays out, you know, somewhat like is reported. They see the creature, one of them shoots at it. They do attack their cabin. It sounds like a very harrowing night they had. And the following day, I think they you know, scared them enough where they packed up their stuff and left. I think the next day they saw a creature and they shot it and it fell off a cliff, I believe.
Oh, wow.
But Fred Beck himself says, you know, these things are supernatural. I forget the exact wording he used, but these things are absolutely of the spiritual realm. They're something other. So they're not ape men. They're something else. And, you know, he's writing this with his son in the 1960s. See, as far as I'm concerned, Fred Beck is way ahead of his time with this stuff. And, you know, all of that is, you know, Josh and I kind of use this term weird washing to say that, you know, people just wash the weird away from so many of these stories to just only present the stuff that sounds like it's a monkey, a giant monkey in the woods. And anything weird associated with it is they just don't mention it. It just goes to the side. And, they, you know, well, we're just going to talk about the stuff that makes it sound like an ape, which is... it's not sound, in my opinion. It's not.
It stems from a desire to sit at the big boys' table of science. Sorry, you know, that's sort of where it's coming from. And Tim and I are like, you know, no, we're dragging them back to the nerds' table. Like, no, you hang out with us.
Well, when you were talking about the arrow or the light and drawing parallels to UFOs, it also made me think of the three wise men, and it sounded kind of faintly biblical too.
Yeah.
Story.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So you think that these stories aren't included, and there's this kind of this Bigfoot washing taking place because they do you think it somehow delegitimizes claims, and certainly for people who have more of a cryptozoological slant, that they think they're being more scientific, and so adding these kinds of elements makes it undermines it somehow?
Yeah, in my view, and it's just, you know, what I think, they're so desperate to be accepted by mainstream science that anything that's crazy, anything that sounds kooky, they want to, you know, remove from the equation.
Sure.
Some things they can't, like glowing eyes, for instance. So, you know, no animal on Earth has glowing eyes. And they want to say it's eye shine. Well, no high order primate has a tapetum lucidum, which is required for eye shine, meaning reflective. Tapetum lucidum is a reflective membrane in the eye. If you drive down the road and you see a deer and their eyes light up and their headlights, that's the tapetum lucidum reflecting your headlights. So they want to say, it's not eye glow, it's eye shine. It's a tapetum lucidum. Well, no high-order primates have this, so that makes them unique among high-order primates, but it doesn't explain all of the witnesses, many, many, many witnesses who insist, no, this wasn't reflection, this was self-illumination. These eyes glowed. They lit up. Some of them change colors. We've had, you know, a couple witnesses I've spoken to said they watched them change colors as they looked at them, blinking like Christmas tree lights. They're insistent. And again, we don't have a lot other than witness testimony. So if a witness says the eyes were self-illuminating, kind of have to go with what the witness said, you know, rather than just go, oh, you're dumb, you're mistaken, you don't know what you were looking at. You know, if you do that, like Josh says, you can roll every case back to, well, you don't know what you're looking at. It must have been a bear.
I think in deer, though, isn't it called hit them when you see them?
Not for me.
I know, but it's totally true, though. I mean, I think, and this is, this filtering issue is something that I think we have a problem with on the skeptical side as well, where we want to filter down to the natural explanation, and that's what we'd like to believe. And it's really easy to say,
what we look to first.
Yeah, it's like, well, and we want it to be natural because that's what we believe is real and plausible.
Our worldview.
But people experience things that are unnatural. I mean, their narratives do not fit the natural world. So I think it leaves us with the problem of, well, we have to assume it's being created in the mind in order to make it fit our belief system. And right. I think the other option is like the cryptozoological people who want it to be natural, they just shave it off. They sand it down to the natural parts.
Well, once again, like I said, no animal on Earth has glowing eyes. But you know what does have glowing eyes? All kinds of things in folklore. Go back through folklore. You'll find stuff left and right with glowing eyes, including eyes that change color.
Yeah.
Glowing eyes that change color. So, you know, different elves and, you know, goblins and trolls and you name it. Glowing eyes.
My daughter and I just watched the animated Hobbit. Last night, and Smaug had glowing eyes. Like his eyes were like spotlights going all over the gold. And I was talking to her about how that's a common thing in folklore, but it makes no biological sense.
Right, exactly. It makes no sense whatsoever. Like you would think, I mean, unless they work by some, you know, mechanics that we don't understand, you would think light up eyes would ruin your night vision, not make them better. You know.
Well, and I think Tim and I still leave the door open for a biological ape if it has like 20 different adaptations that have no precedent in the animal kingdom. Like then we're okay with it, because you know, we sort of systematically go through not only stuff like the tapetum lucidum, but you know, these footprints, the trackways sometimes just end in the middle of these fields, and people will say, oh, the Bigfoot jumped, you know, to harder media that wouldn't transfer their footprints. But sometimes these are like literally in a field where there's nothing, there's, you know, untouched mud or untouched snow for like 100 yards. So there's nothing on the planet that can jump that far. So yeah, just trying to go through all these different, you know, explanations. Oh, well, Bigfoot jump. Oh, well, if you have 3-toed Bigfoot tracks, they're inbred. And trying to just show why these are not satisfying answers. And if they are, they kind of go against everything we know about mammals and primates and all this stuff. But I think a lot of the problem, part of the reason that a lot of cryptozoologists are so hesitant to embrace some of this weirder stuff is that they just aren't as up to speed on consciousness studies as I think the ghost hunting crowd and the UFO crowd are. Because when you start entertaining a lot of those ideas, some of this other stuff becomes a lot more palatable.
Ooh, you want to unpack that a little bit?
So there aren't a lot of hills that I'll die on in the paranormal / supernatural, but consciousness studies are pretty high up there. They're things that are happening in laboratories that are not dramatic, but they do seem to illustrate that certain people under certain conditions can nudge statistics for certain events in statistically significant ways. So again, not dramatic changes, but some really significant ones. For example, there are some studies that Dean Radin, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but
Dean Radin. Very familiar, yep.
Okay, yeah. So I'm thinking about some of Dean Radin's stuff that is measurable at the six sigma threshold, which means that basically the overall odds against chance for anything else comparable would be, you know, assessed at over a billion to one. So there's some really good laboratory work happening there. And what's interesting about a lot of this consciousness stuff is that if consciousness is not tied to matter and is somehow fundamental, then it really does introduce an X factor into literally everything that we do. And people have been looking at this from the laboratory angle and also from, you know, the psychedelic angle. I'm taking a look at, you know, trying to sort of almost map these DMT realms. You know, Rick Strassman did some great work back in the 90s at the University of New Mexico. I believe it was back in the 90s, where people are having some experiences that are consistent and veridical. And the UFO crowd has really embraced these as saying, look, here's a mechanism perhaps by which we can explain the consistencies of these sightings. But you have the, you know, Bigfoot community saying things like, well, Bigfoot can't be anything but an animal because only animals leave footprints. But again, if these psi results are true, then the intangible nature of psychic phenomena has a tangible impact on the world, which means that the non-physical can impact the physical. And I think that's something that a lot of these cryptozoologists ignore at their peril, because once you start looking at this in sort of a weirder angle, a folkloric angle, an angle that's sort of embracing that sort of bleeding edge of consciousness science, things become a little bit more palatable, I think.
Yeah, we've talked before on our show about the Skinwalker Ranch case, and mm-hmm. I think it always felt like an outlier. But if these cases are having the paranormal sanded off before they go into publication, maybe their portal Bigfoot isn't so weird.
Well, Skinwalker's a big problem anyway, because I think that, so you can't deny the fact that, like, the Uinta Basin is a weird area. It has a lot of strange folklore, a lot of strange sightings not tied to the Sherman Ranch. But there's some really good research that was done by Erica Lukes, a UFO researcher, that has pretty much settled the case for me that there were at least some instances where non-violent technology, like crowd control technology, was being tested on people without their consent. There's some really shady paperwork buried in some of the documents around some of the people who, you know, were guards there and whatnot. And it seems like that's at least a component. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that it was odd there to begin with, and the government thought that they could sort of write off these tests as being, ooh, spooky supernatural? Maybe. Or does it mean that, you know, the government's somehow harnessing some forces there, which is a little bit more fanciful, perhaps? But there does seem to be a component there that was really just people doing things to people, the government doing things to people without their consent. It really does appear that way.
Okay, I want to shift gear a little bit and just talk about the first volume in particular, and you focus on folklore in that book. So I'm wondering how you've already spoken about some witnesses that you've had conversations with. How did you go about collecting stories for the book and deciding what to put in and what to leave out?
We cast a pretty wide net. So we looked at Bigfoot literature. We looked at old newspaper articles. Other books, I collect a lot of these old, you know, before it was known as Bigfoot, they called them Wild Man. So a lot of these old newspaper reports. So we had all those to pull from. I do field work. So I'm in York County, Pennsylvania. I think I'm the guy. And maybe there's another guy, but I think I'm the guy that people call when there's a Bigfoot encounter. I like to think I'm the guy. I hope I'm the guy. So I meet a lot of witnesses.
Go-to guy?
You want to give out your number? Right.
They can find me at strangefamiliars.com. I do not want to give out my number. Witness testimony, you know, when available. I meet a lot of witnesses through my podcast as well. I have, you know, people come on and tell their stories. So, you know, it was a pretty wide net we cast. And we looked, you know, as wide and far, I think, as we could, you know, for examples of these stories. And and there was no shortage of them. We didn't have a problem finding weird Bigfoot stories.
Are we predominantly looking in, sorry to interrupt, predominantly in North America, or you were looking around the world?
Around the world, just to, a lot of times to demonstrate. So, if I'm talking about glowing eyes, which I talk about in the second book, but, just as an example, I want to try to lay some cases of stuff in, around the world just to show that it's not just happening here. But it ends up being, I think we're in America. So I think, the vast majority of everything comes from the United States.
The strange stuff.
Yeah, but especially I'm thinking of, Yowie folklore in Australia has especially got a real high strange tinge to it.
It definitely does. I think there's a lot of influence too. I live in the States, but we talked a lot about.
I said that just for you, actually. So, I think probably the next strangest large hairy cryptid is the Yowie. But part of that is that a lot of these cultures, have not tried to force these large wild men into the science box. So you don't hear about the stories being strange as much. They're always framed in like spirit context and whatnot. But a lot of it too was, Timothy, I think between Timothy and I, we've got a pretty solid grasp on some of the things to look for that are anomalous. And in a lot of cases, some of the stuff that we pulled from was from very straightforward sources that just didn't quite realize, I think some of them didn't quite realize what they were reporting or what they were saying, because it's like, oh, that thing that you just said lines up with this, Russian wood sprite from this one obscure manuscript or whatever, that sort of thing. I think a lot of the benefit, and I've said this a couple of times, for me, is that Timothy has such a great background in field work that it really complemented what I do well. Tim does what I do well as well, but Tim bringing that combination of field work and some personal experience to it was really exciting. And I think our brains both sort of work in the same way on this stuff.
Well, I think one of the interesting things is when you're thinking about how to decide what to include and what to exclude, you're facing the same challenge of what is within a category and what's not within a category. And when you look at the wild man, the hairy man, the Bigfoot, the three-toed Bigfoot, the five-toed Bigfoot, there's all these, the Enkidu from Gilgamesh. I mean, there's so many places where you go, well, that's probably a Bigfoot, or that's probably a Bigfoot. But is it? I mean, like, are these things the same or are they different? And from a biological sense, it makes no sense to put a three-toed thing with a five-toed thing. But from a hairy humanoid perspective, it makes a lot of sense to lump them together narratively. So how did you, try to use those sort of categorizations in your work?
Well, for the sake of the apers, they better hope it's all the same thing. Well, otherwise, they're going to have to explain what 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different kinds of hairy creatures, upright walking creatures that are out there. So they better hope it's all the same. But no, I think, loosely, if it was hairy and walked on two legs, it was fair game for us.
So I'm actually one of the creatures in this book.
Yes. Yeah, in a broad definition. So, yeah, this is just really interesting to me because on the surface of things, it sounds like it's a new angle on Bigfoot. But really what you're saying is a lot of these stories have been around for a long time. So it's really an older angle, I guess. And we've kind of changed our perception of what Bigfoot is over time.
Well, I don't like to dwell on this too long, but there is kind of a weird colonialist vibe to a lot of cryptozoology,
No. Dwell.
Coming in and saying, oh, those silly natives, they believe this thing
savages.
Disappears. It must absolutely be jumping into a ditch or behind a tree because we know things can't disappear. So a lot of it,
Sure.
I do think Tim and I went to some great pains to look at a lot of indigenous lore and to not treat the cultures as monolithic, because North America, people said that this thing was a spirit. They said it was an ape. They said it was a man who became a spirit. They said it was a little half and half, like all sorts of different things. So you can't say, you know, in Native American folklore, Bigfoot is so and so. It's really trying to zero in on a lot of these individual tribes. But that's, I think that's the thing that I found startling, is that some of the things that you see in modern reports are absolutely described in a lot of this older literature. I mean, one of the things that cryptozoologists used like to trot out as sort of a, I guess not Deus Ex Machina, I guess it's Deus Ex Sasquatch, to answer everything is infrasound, you know? So if Bigfoot disappeared, he zapped you with infrasound, which are these subsonic frequencies that indeed can disorient. Oh, Bigfoot zapped you with infrasound and your vision went hazy, and that's why you didn't see where it went. And they like to keep on trotting that out, but to a lot of indigenous people, it was, no, these creatures have the ability to hypnotize you. And that kind of seems like a more parsimonious place to to start from than saying everything is infrasound. Because infrasound, I think Tim and I have a running joke that, like, everything that's strange is always infrasound.
Yeah, yeah. It's the it's marsh gas for UFOs, right? So, a pet peeve of mine is the people, you know, the Bigfooters who want to say that Native American folklore about hairy men is definitely Bigfoot, and that's a real animal, but they're just going to ignore the talking coyote. Right. Like, okay, wait a minute. Yeah. It's common folklore, you know. I don't think it's right to just, you know, pick out the things you like and just exclude everything else as myth, right? So I think
that's what we do.
That's exactly along the colonial appropriation stuff you're talking about, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But going back to cases that are commonly talked about in Bigfoot lore and they shave off the weird. Or sand, maybe I should say sand off. They sent off the weird. But maybe there's no better case than that of the Momo story, because that's one that always seemed a little weird, the way it gets stuck into a lot of Bigfoot books, but it's a lot weird. That is a strange case. Could you talk a little bit about the Momo story? And we're probably going to end up doing a whole episode about that, because I've just started watching the Small Town Monsters coverage, and I love how they're doing it as a sort of a lost movie thing. That's really funny. Mm-hmm. So,
I asked Seth Breedlove when he came on my show. I was like, "Did you do?" Because I hadn't seen the Momo thing when he came on yet. I was like, "Did you cover the weird stuff?" He said, "Oh yeah, yeah, we cover the weird stuff." They kind of like dip their toe in the weird stuff. In
it's weird. It's a weird case.
yeah. It's really, really odd. And I think probably Josh can speak to it better than I. I went into it a little bit in one of my chapters, but he really kind of went into it a little bit more. I mean, there's UFOs and there's voices from the woods and I'll go ahead and let Josh speak to it, because like I said,
there's Bigfoot like coffee. That's these are good questions.
Yeah, exactly. Well, way back in 1972, in the incredibly confusingly named town of Louisiana, Missouri, the Harrison family saw a large hairy creature. It was, you know, tall, over average man sized, and was carrying a dead dog. And this sort of kicked off a series of basically monster hunts in the area, where this creature was seen, and sometimes they would go into places where they thought it had been, and there was this horrible smell, and they thought, well, maybe the smell is some sort of defense mechanism or this or that or the other. But it's interesting, because at the same time that this was happening, there was a lot of associated UFO phenomena.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face-Off launches April 9th.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about. The stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
4 days after that initial sighting, there was actually a Pentecostal church that was letting out, and the congregation saw two fireballs shoot from this area called Mars Off Hill, which is where they thought Momo was hiding out. And one was white and the other one was green, and they actually descended into the woods far off. Later there was another UFO sighting of something that formed this perfect gold cross on the moon, which I kind of think sounds a little bit like Fatima or something.
Yeah.
Apparently it lit the road up like it was as bright as day for them to drive. There were a couple other fireballs that were seen in the area as well. As you alluded to, a couple of examples of these anomalous voices that were in the woods. People who were searching for Momo would hear things like, you know, "You boys stay out of these woods," by this old man voice, or, you know, one of them famously said, I'll take your cup of coffee," which is really strange.
Over my dead body.
Yeah, right.
"You can have my cup of coffee when you trade me some tasteless pancakes for it."
Right. And just more of these weird UFOs were seen. And that's also a case where supposedly Momo, Missouri Monster, left behind these three-toed tracks. You know, these three-toed footprints, people who are conventional Bigfooters will say that they only occur in specific areas, and it's indicative of, you know, inbreeding or something. If you've ever looked at one of these footprints, they're not a deformity. Like, there's just no way. They look like these giant, like, three-pronged, almost chicken feet kind of things that are, you know, the
emu.
And it's manifested identically on both feet. So if it was a deformity, it probably wouldn't do that. If it was an injury, it probably wouldn't manifest across both feet. And they're actually pretty consistent. But what's interesting is that there are plenty of examples in folklore, not only some indigenous folklore here in the U.S., but also in Europe, of, you know, chicken-footed apes or turkey-footed apes. There was an example from County Tipperary in Ireland where the fairy queen was upset that someone was, you know, building on her fairyland. So she actually ended up transforming into an ape with turkey feet. So I don't know what to make of that, but that's another folklore connection. And I think if you look at that coupled with, you know, a lot of this witch folklore that, you know, some witches would have chicken's feet and some fairies would have chicken's feet as well. It just raises a lot more questions than answers, but somehow that's still more convincing to me than the conventional explanation that it's a deformity or that it's an injury or something.
It is definitely some kind of foul beast.
Womp, womp.
I warned you. So in your research, you talk about the intersection between Bigfoot and an astonishing array of phenomena that I wouldn't have typically linked in my head. And you've already spoken a little bit about fairies and UFOs and now witches too. But I'm interested in the links between Bigfoot and poltergeists and women in white and ghosts. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your findings there?
You want to start with poltergeist, Josh?
Yeah, I guess so. So I really wish that I could take, you know, full credit for this, but it had kind of been mentioned in passing in a lot of, you know, cryptozoological circles that, oh, you know, if you take a look at all the Bigfoot stuff without Bigfoot, it kind of looks like poltergeist cases. And it's true. If you look at sort of that subset of what the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization call Class B reports, which are basically, you know, thrown stones, anomalous voices, anomalous smells, you know, large footprints, feelings of being watched, you know, knocks, or, you know, wood knocks is what they call them, but knocks or raps in the forest. If you take that same suite of phenomena and you put it in a house, it's a poltergeist. Like, that's what everybody would call it, a haunting or a poltergeist.
Yeah.
So a lot of this stuff, I think we're looking at a lot of the same things.
Well, in terms actually, of this blanket with those normal three-toed feet, are they poltergeists?
Oh, my Lord. It's the dad joke hour.
Sorry.
I blame Tim because he started with that Vander White joke, which was just...
It's an endemic problem on this show. I apologize. I lightly apologize. Sorry, go ahead.
It's been a pandemic problem in my house. I have my whole family doing these stupid puns now.
It's a pandemic, yep.
Yes, so a lot of these things really do seem context-dependent.
Yeah.
And I find it even more interesting that, you know, the two places that you would see poltergeist occur were typically, you know, A, around a young person, typically a female with sexual frustration, that all that sort of ageist, sexist research has been expanded with the guy by the name of Christopher Larson, who has pretty much demonstrated that poltergeist phenomena can happen to anybody. We sort of need to abandon that idea. But the idea was that poltergeist phenomena in parapsychological circles was understood to not so much be a spirit phenomena, but it would tend to happen around adolescent focal points. Or it would happen in seances, you know, these spiritualist seances that you'd find in the late 1800s and whatnot. And interestingly enough, I can think of at least three or four different cases where during these spiritualist seances, they actually manifested a large hairy man. I believe it was Franek Kluski was a famed medium who manifested one, and the paranormal author Stan Gooch, I believe, was at a seance where he saw this figure that was either like a caveman covered in furs or an ape man covered in hair. So again, that's just another connection that says maybe we're looking at something completely different out there in the woods that isn't, you know, if you incorporate that poltergeist idea, it helps to not only explain the stuff that we associate with Bigfoot, but also the weirder stuff that people want to throw out.
Did you talk about lithobaly, Josh?
Lithobaly. I always said lithobaly, but that's probably because I live in Georgia. lithobaly, the throwing of stones. I'm glad that Tim brought that up because, like, that's something that you see in poltergeist cases, Bigfoot cases, you know, generalized hauntings, witch stories, and fairy stories as well. The idea that these stones will be thrown out of nowhere. In poltergeist cases, they are often a porse, and there are some really good reports and some pretty good evidence of these stones like manifesting in the middle of a room. A really famous poltergeist was the Humpty Doo poltergeist of Australia, and they actually reported some of this. I heard a sigh.
Yeah, I was working with a group called the Australian Skeptics at the time that this happened. And so I wasn't directly involved, but I do know of that story, and it's a great name, isn't it?
And Humpty-Doo is literally one of my favorite words at this point. So yeah.
It's a great name. I'm sure that you have opinions, so I'll just leave the I'll sort of pivot and say they captured evidence consistent with what people report in poltergeist cases, which is that literally these stones are warm to the touch. And they allegedly captured a stone on thermal video that actually started hot and got colder. These reports, whatever it is, seem to start out warm and get colder. And this actually happens in Bigfoot reports, but people have always been assuming that the Bigfoot was, you know, holding rocks in its hand or something. But if you look at the Minerva monster flap of, I believe, the 1970s in Minerva, Ohio, some of the kids who had interactions with this Bigfoot creature up on the ridge behind their house said that they would, you know, take a rock and mark an X on it and throw the stone. And when the stone would be thrown back, it would be warm to the touch.
With what I saw, I think it was a Channel 7 news or something, or some current affairs TV show that went in there and did some filming at the time. and actually caught one of the members of the household throwing rocks and throwing batteries and other things. But I think that they claimed it was kind of a pious fraud thing where, oh, the phenomena was true, but they were having to try to prove to this TV crew what was going on to give them an example of that kind of thing. But I think that there were batteries found on fans as well that would send them hurling around the room and all different kinds of things.
Well, and you know, that's something that I realize this is going to sound like being an apologist of the highest order, but I will agree that, you know, every time, you know, you see these poltergeist cases, there often is some point during the investigation where people are literally just faking stuff. I tend to be of the opinion that a lot of these things will, a lot of people will have startling things happen to them. You know, genuinely anomalous things, and then they're asked to provide evidence or to, you know, to sort of perform for it. And, you know, you see this in the Uri Geller spoon bending, and you see this in every poltergeist case. You see it in, you know, the contactees of the 1960s and 70s, the UFO contactees who had these incredible experiences and then kind of developed these weird cults and religions around themselves. I think that that's part of the phenomena, and, you know,
Well, we talked to Guy Lyon Playfair about the infill poltergeist, and he talked about that as well, where, you know, he believed it was all real, but Janice did fake some of it and got caught. You know, it's just like all these, it seems to be a common thing among, like, literally every poltergeist case where at least once or twice someone's caught faking it, and it's always about them saying that they felt pressure to continue something that was not reliable, you know, and I'm sympathetic, you know. I'm super skeptical, but I certainly can feel the, like, once the story has gotten to that point that there's people there looking for the phenomena, there's got to be
the people who really believe.
Yeah, there's got to be a lot of pressure, you know.
Well,
yeah.
And you know, if you look at this from like a meta, not a metaphysical, but just like a meta, like textual level.
Right. Yeah.
George Hansen's The Trickster and the Paranormal has said that this is just what happens because a lot of these paranormal phenomena embody that trickster archetype, and the trickster archetype really does, it's sort of self-defeating, self-negating. So the idea that there is some sort of, again, I'm a big fan of archetypes, I know Tim is too, but there's some sort of archetypal drive that nature, that in its nature sort of never wishes to be discovered and sort of orchestrates and pulls the strings behind the scenes. I know that sounds kind of silly and highfalutin, but I kind of love that idea too at the same time, and it is admittedly a convenient excuse, but it is very consistent with a lot of what he's seen, because you see the same thing with gurus and to the extent that, you know, gurus and con men are often sort of the same thing. That was the one of Hansen's big things as well.
And coming from the skeptical side, I find it interesting because I see the archetype as being a culturally available template that people feel compelled to conform to. And so, you know, whether either of our sides, like either interpretation is real, we still find this common narrative structural thread in common across these things. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah. It scratches my my inner Jungian, inner literary critic sort of itch that I have. You know.
Well, you're young at heart.
In terms of classification, then, if we're talking about poltergeist-like activity and Bigfoot-like descriptions or symptoms of poltergeist, are we talking about these things being classified as Bigfoot or poltergeist or both? I guess it gets a bit muddy.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of gets to my earlier comment about fairies and aliens. I think Tim and I would both just agree and say the other. Tim has a great quote that he's sort of workshopping around. I hear him lately talking about, hey, Tim, it's all poltergeists. It's all fairies. What do you say?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm really agnostic on the categorization of this stuff. I tend to think fairy lore maybe has the most accurate interpretation of a lot of this stuff. But having said that, I don't think it's accurate at all. All I really feel comfortable saying is that I strongly suspect that we're dealing with that a lot of things in the paranormal have some sort of genuine basis. And even if not, I think we overestimate the number of genuine hoaxes and frauds there are in this field. I think that a lot of the just average reports and cases and accounts that you see, if they are not truthful, are just misidentifications. I don't think there are a lot of people who are outright lying. In other words, the people believe that they saw what they saw. And I think Tim's experiences on Strange Familiars would sort of speak to that as well. Didn't you say you had somebody who had a, I don't know where you talk about this, Tim, but you had somebody who was a, who like read voices for a living or something?
Yeah, he was trained at a casino, and they trained him to tell when people were lying. And he was talking to me about the show, and he said, now this is probably around, you know, episode 100 or so. So say I've had maybe 80 guests on at that point. And at that time he told me, you know, hey, I really like your show. He's like, out of all of it, you know, with my training, he said there were two people that were lying. Do you want to know who they are? And I said, no, I absolutely don't want to know, because I don't want to know. But he said, that's a pretty good record. He's like, I can tell when people are lying. No, I don't know. You know, I've taken him at his word too. Maybe he couldn't tell, but if he was accurate, that's pretty good.
That's the thing, you know, as skeptics, I think we always take the position that until you prove something, it's we have to assume it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly people are reporting stuff sincerely a lot of the time, whether it's their interpretation is real or not. They experienced something, and that's how they came away from it. You know, that's what they got out of it, was something paranormal, supernatural. Yeah, we think a lot of them are jumping to conclusions, but you can't deny that people have weird experiences, and it's what they make of it, right? That's what I find fascinating.
And that
at
it's
this
common,
point.
Yeah.
Yeah, my wife was, you know, is a, very much a skeptic, and she moved from literally saying, you're all crazy, to she came with me to a few conferences and so forth, and I get great stories there. People, I know when I'm going to get a story, because someone will stand away from my table about 10 feet and wait till everybody else is gone. They'll kind of like shuffle their feet and look down, and everybody else will leave, and they'll come up, and they'll start out just like, you really believe in this stuff? And, you know, I say, yeah, you know, I talk to people all the time. And then they'll, you know, once they get comfortable, they'll tell their story. And she's been at the table with me and heard people tell their story. And you know, I remember specifically, like, this one fellow, like, just waited and came and specifically asked to talk to me. And came up, and his daughter actually had to lead him up and like talk to this guy, like you know, no one has believed me about this. And he sat there and talked to me. He was very emotionally moved and so happy that he could just get this story off his chest. And he walked away when he was done. I mean, I begged him to come on my podcast. He had no interest in that. He just wanted to tell a story and go. He walked away, and my wife looked at me, and she, you know, very sincerely said, I don't know what he saw, but he saw something. And that's all I asked for. That's all I can ask for. That to me, that's like honest skepticism. Like, you know, she's just like, I don't know what he saw, but he saw something. And that's to me, that's like I said, that's an honest skepticism. And I can't really ask anybody to go further than that. You know, I tend to take witnesses at their word. But if you just want to go with, I don't know what they saw, but they saw something, that's completely honest, I think.
Sometimes I wonder if like the whole shebang isn't about belief, you know, because if you look at stories of any of these things, alien abduction, Bigfoot encounters, you know, fairy encounters, or djinn encounters, I should say, they can all be dispelled through prayer to whatever you believe in. And this is interesting because, you know, Christian myself, but having said that, it doesn't seem to really matter what you pray to in these encounters. And that makes me wonder if belief and intention aren't really what a lot of these things, if they are real, draw their power from.
I have a really complicated view of belief as being tied into like a neurological predictive model, where like we evaluate the world through like a neurological structure of belief. Like, it's like literally a physical modeling system where we decide what's real and what fits with our world and what doesn't. And I have to say that like those matters of faith, where we can push away the thing, we can reject things we don't believe, like literally they literally don't fit with our neural model of the world, so therefore they're just not real. I think there's something to that, whether like that doesn't tell us whether things are real or not. It's just about whether we as individuals accept them or not, you know.
Oh, that's interesting, because I kind of go the other way, where I'm saying, like, the other, whatever these other things are not allowed to confirm one way or another. So that in other words, they almost respect any amount of faith. So, you know, it doesn't matter. They're not allowed to confirm. Yeah,
that's the Fright Night model. You got to have faith, right? I love that.
I'm wondering what you pray to if you see Bigfoot then.
Ooh, whatever's handy.
The god of dry underwear.
I'm the skeptic who always looks for Bigfoot at night when I'm driving. You know, it's like I want to speed up and hit it, because if it's real, I want to leave a dent in my fender and have some evidence, right? So, yeah.
You may hit it. You may dent your fender. Yeah. But even if you killed it, it wouldn't be around for long.
Well, that's possible as well. But I'm sure going to try. That's
100% of the time, people who have claimed to kill it or possess a body in one way or another, not 99% of the time, not 99.1% of the time, 100% of the time, the bodies disappear. They go missing without question.
I think the one exclusion would be the Bigfoot here in Georgia, which turned out to be a suit full of possum guts. But yeah, other than that.
If there ever was a real body, and I don't think there was in that case.
Well, now there's that question as well. Yeah. I'm embarrassed for my state.
That's one of those hoaxes that Josh writes about in his trickster chapter.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that, you know, I sort of mentioned George Hansen's trickster thing, and he talks about how hoaxes embody these specific aspects we saw time and again that are all, again, aspects of these trickster figures. You know, social leveling is a big thing with a lot of these trickster figures because they upset norms and social norms. And, you know, with the Georgia Bigfoot hoax, you had a police officer who claimed that he was working with a con man to get, you know, not a con man, sorry, a convict to get the Bigfoot body out of the woods. but also social leveling in terms of someone being brought low because he was like this decorated police officer because he had been wounded in the line of duty and he completely lost his job and was disgraced after this. And again, the idea of liminality, he cooked up this hoax during this time where he was on medical leave, so he wasn't employed, but he wasn't now employed, so you've got that liminal aspect in there as well. It really is interesting to see how these things, again, from a Jungian perspective, really do seem to adhere to those archetypes.
I never thought of this before. Maybe he was on pain medicine. Maybe he was an oxymoron.
They scared him away.
That was terrible. Sorry. I did.
You've done better. You've done better. Let's put it that way.
I'm just upset being out dad joked left and right here. I'm outmatched.
I just wanted to say, though, you know, skepticism aside, I mean, I don't think that's really a factor here. I loved these books and highly recommend them to our listeners. They are a tremendous service to the field because I think they're collecting all the stuff that's sanded off in the other literature. Like, whether I agree whether this stuff's real or not, you guys are doing a great job of bringing a bright light onto a whole segment of the field that's commonly just pushed off into the shadows. And it needn't be. Even though I've seen it before and noticed it, you brought a bunch of stuff to bear that I had not read. And I think you raise a really critical question. You know, issue here. And I do have to wonder, besides that, so that's me praising the books, links in the show notes. How has this been accepted or received by the Pelts and Paws crowd? The people who believe in cryptozoology and believe this is a real sort of segment of biology, how have they felt about this book or these two books and this sort of bringing a light to this part of the field?
I was just going to say, I love Pelts and Paws. I also love Tracks and Turds. But Pelts and Paws is pretty darn good. Go ahead, Tim.
I think they're desperately trying to ignore it and really, really wishing it would just go away. But it's not. And happily, I think with some people, it's forcing a change in the conversation. And it's forcing them to at least acknowledge that this weird stuff happened. I mean, the simplest way to put it is we don't have much other than witness testimony. And if you're going to believe a witness when they say, I saw an 8-foot tall ape man in the woods and then toss out the part where they say, but its hair was bright green, or its eyes were glowing, or there was a UFO flying over its head, it's not intellectually honest at all. You have to, if you're going to take the witness at their word that they saw an ape man, then you got to include the whole account. And so many of these accounts have been just weird washed and so forth that, you know, let's have the conversation, but that's, if we're going to use witness testimony, which, like I said, that's, we don't have a lot more. We got some really nice footprints and stuff, casts, but beyond that, we don't have a lot more than witness testimony. If we're going to use witness testimony, then let's use all of the witness testimony and let's believe people, you know, all the way then.
Yeah. That was weird washed. Earlier I said Bigfoot washed. It's been a long day.
Oh, no, you're good. And I would add to that the fact that, like, I don't know if some of these stories are true, but I do find it fascinating when you see something from somebody who submitted a report to the BFRO and never believed in something, and they say something really specific that you can find, you know, referenced a couple of places in this text that, you know, somebody from, you know, Pelham, Georgia would never have read this, right? They would have never, even with the internet, they would never have, it's highly unlikely that they would have found this one little detail from folklore and, you know, sure enough, it's there. So I don't know what that means. I don't know if it means that, you know, we as human beings all have, again, collective unconscious, if we all have this idea of what, you know, the supernatural should be, and, you know, we have these experiences and we sort of graft those universally held beliefs onto it, or what. But I think it's really, I think that's really where a lot of these unexplained anomalous studies really gain their strength, is from that longitudinal comparison. But in terms of the reception, there was some snark from some people early on. We had some, Tim and I had some snark before we even released the book, didn't we, Tim? But it's been a lot. I haven't heard as much afterwards, really, at all. I think there's a couple people here and there, but nobody has really been, for me at least, combative or confrontational about it. I think Tim's had some more interactions with people than I have, but you know, this was begging to be written, and I feel, you know, lucky that we were able to do it, but it really should have been written a long time ago, because I've heard for a long time that once you get the people at the conference out to the bar after their lecture and you get a couple drinks in them, that's when they start saying, you know what's weird? I saw all these, you know, orbs of light when we were on our Bigfoot hunt. We didn't see any Bigfoot, but people had seen Bigfoot there and before in the past, and all we saw were these lights, or, you know, just I see all these weird synchronicities and stuff. So,
and you know,
I think these
say,
things happen. Yeah.
Once you go portal Bigfoot, you never go mortal Bigfoot. That's what they say.
I like that. I like that a lot.
But I think it's such a great concept for a book, and you're right. This really should have been written earlier. And over the years, Blake and I have encountered some of these kinds of links, and just the more you talk about these connections, it's a lot more evident to us. But I still can't really see the link between Bigfoot and women in white. Oh. So is there a particular story there? I'm just curious about that. I know we need to close off soon, but
Thank you for remembering that. And I'll say, this is my little disclaimer that I say every time Tim talks about this. I thought Tim was absolutely full of it. He's like, have you ever noticed that people see cryptids or Bigfoot and they see women in white? And I was like, no, Tim, you're full of it. And sure enough, he comes back with like what I think is the best chapter out of that first book. So I'll sit back now.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, how soon did you want to close up the show?
Talk as long as you like.
So this started on Sasquatch Chronicles, and there's a certain case where these two brothers are seeing all these different Bigfoot creatures and so forth. And then they start seeing this weird woman walking around their neighborhood who was in these white, she always wore white and had these like oversized shoes. And this is a really interesting aspect to the case that I took note of, kind of paid attention in the forums there. And then other people started saying, hey, I saw this weird woman in white and drove down the road 2 miles and then saw Bigfoot and, you know, things like that. And I started kind of paying attention to it. And then I was some folks ended up coming on my podcast, but they had their own podcast, and they were talking about seeing this ghost of this woman in white. And I, for some reason, I thought you're going to see a cryptid. They're going to see a cryptid. And then within days, they saw like what conforms to like the devil monkey kind of saying, like a 4 or 5 foot tall kind of baboon like creature. They saw this thing within days. And so then I was like, oh my goodness. So I started talking about it a little on my podcast, and I was contacted by another local guy who said, you know, hey, I had all these Bigfoot experiences, meet me out in this area called Palm Bank. So I meet him there that day, and that's not where he had his Bigfoot experience. It was like less than a mile away from his experience as the crow flies. And he says, do you know why we're here? I said, no. He's like, well, my experience was, you know, up the mountain a little ways. He's like, but this is a place called Palm Bank. And right here, there's a story of a woman in white and this whole legend of this, you know, ghost of a woman in white. So now I'm thinking, okay, so there has to be something to this. I went to another local site, and a guy had seen 2 Bigfoot on his property. And I did all the normal stuff. He saw them across the pond. I went over there with my walking stick. How tall were they? You know, I'm raising my stick. Tell me when to stop. Where were they standing, et cetera, et cetera. As I'm packing up my stuff, he kind of comes up to me, and he just offhandedly mentions, like, you know, my house is haunted too. And me being who I am, I'm like, okay, it's like, put the brakes on. Tell me about this. And he starts telling me about all this poltergeist phenomenon and showing me pictures of these very typical kind of ghost pictures, these kind of hazy, kind of smoky figures he'd taken photos of. And he said, but I have one that's clear as day. I took in my mirror. I was like, well, let me see it. And he shows me this photo, and it's a woman in a white dress. He just took a picture of her in his mirror. I was like, oh, my goodness. So now I'm like, okay, there's something to this. And it was probably around this time that I mentioned to Josh, and he was kind of like, well, you know, you go for that, Tim. Go ahead, waste your time on that. I started digging in, and so I'm looking into these women in white sightings in Europe. The royal families in Europe would have these women in white sightings, and they would always predict death for them. And I came across, I think it was the Austrian royal family. They had a name for this woman, and they called her Bertha. And it said... I'm reading about this, and now Bertha is a sort of a medieval form of Perkta. And they called her a goddess. She's not quite a goddess. She's more of a fairy figure, one of these, like a Baba Yaga or you know, one of these sort of...
very folklore-y, witchy sort of figure. Yeah.
And I was like, well, now I need to look into this. So I'm looking into Perkta, and this is what blew the whole thing open for me. So it says, you know, Perkta always wore white. She would appear either as young and beautiful or as an old hag. She had, very interesting, either one or both feet were oversized and took the form of a swan's foot. So here we have the three-toed bird foot again. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting, this woman in white. But then it broke down to her kind of retinue. And she has these two groups that follow her around. One is known as the Heimchen. And these are all the souls of the lost children that she you know, lured into the woods and who died. And they take the form of will-o'-the-wisps. So here we have these orbs that follow her around. And then the other part of her retinue, and this is just what sealed the deal for me, was what's called the Perkton. And this is a group of hairy wild men that follow her around. And right then I was like, okay, this is a thing. And started looking in folklore all over the world. And there is example after example. I've not found it in Asia yet. And I'm saying yet because I have confidence that at some point I'm going to find something. But all over the world, in Africa, you know, Native American accounts in Europe, there are these folkloric wild men and their wife or their female counterpart, or there's different names for them, is a woman who wears white, or sometimes, rarely, a lot less common, it is a white creature. It's a similar creature, but she's also white. But it's just again and again. It's in Russia. It's in England. It's, you know, all across Europe. It's everywhere in Northern Africa, I think. Just, it's incredible, and it just keeps going and going. And you know, at this point, we found probably just as much again that I listed in the book that people have contacted us with since then. It's just like, here's another example.
And Baba Yaga lives in a hut that travels around on chicken feet.
Fowl's legs, yep, exactly. Yeah. And there's some Baba Yaga analogs in like Siberia that are tall and covered in hair and bulletproof, which is another thing that people talk about Bigfoot. You know, but people have sort of taken this and run with it in terms of. We had one guy who said that he was wondering if like the Christmas tree wasn't. The Bigfoot, like a representation of Bigfoot itself, because you know, you've got the tree, which is the outdoors, and you've got the balls, which are the balls of, you know, the orbs of light that people see around Bigfoot, and you've got the woman in white as the angel on the top, and of course Santa Claus is Bigfoot. I mean, Santa Claus is a wild man, you know. there's a clear I mean, we could probably do a third book just on this, Tim. There's a clear line that you can trace through Dionysus and the Green Man and Odin and the Wild Man and Santa Claus and satyrs.
Well, and how bombs. Many blurry photos have been taken in front of a Christmas tree on Christmas morning? Exactly.
It's the Bigfoot force field. And then the Thomas Campion thing, Tim.
Yes, you're going to make me try to remember that quote.
Them that die maids lead apes in hell.
That was a quote used in, I think, late medieval, early Renaissance time. And it started out as a sort of in use to by Protestants to take a jab at the Catholic clergy, priests and nuns. If you look into it, there's all these, again, folkloric stories that sort of conform to that. Is that the aspect of it you wanted me to dig into, Josh?
No, I just thought it was interesting because you've got that, then the die maids implies, as you mentioned, white and then leading apes in hell.
Well, I was also just going to add that the women in white, when you were initially telling me the story, it made me think of Vanishing Hitchhikers. And I just wondered if there was some possible link to those kinds of stories too, like Resurrection Mary, a woman in white who keeps reappearing, and if there's might be some kind of link there too.
Yeah, well, I mean, you tend to get these women in white stories, and then you can kind of map Bigfoot accounts on top of them a lot of times. A lot of times, you know, people will see them in the same place. You know, in general, the woman in white, like archetype, spirit, whatever you want to call it, is universal, and it's even more common than the wild man, for sure. So you get these women in white stories, certainly without the wild man associated with it, and you get wild man stories without the woman in white. But you know, I found so many accounts of it that there's some, you know, maybe not all the time, but there's definitely a relationship there worth exploring, I think.
Sure.
That's a really good question. I have described a couple times this project to Tim as drinking through a hose, you know, because there really is. We've been told for years and years and years that these weird Bigfoot things are, these examples are outliers. They don't happen that often. And, you know, if they do happen, it's a coincidence. And man, we left a lot of stuff out. We really left a lot of stuff out.
Yeah, we could have. I mean, no, I don't think we could have been exhaustive, you know, and put every case. We just used a few cases to, you know, illustrate each point. In some chapters, we use more than others because something, you know, like weird lights in Bigfoot. You know, I think we use a lot more examples than other chapters just to show people like how common it is for people to see, you know, weird lights around Bigfoot. But in no case did we use everything. And if we, I like to say, if we used every weird case we found, there probably would have been 10 books. You know, it's just, there's so much of it. There's no shortage of it.
Yeah, and to say nothing of tracking down every eyewitness that we can, you know, I mean, it's just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to highly recommend, I'm not high, I'm just a little buzzed, but I want to highly recommend your books to our listeners. I really enjoyed them. I think they will too. I think you do a really important bit of work here. Pulling out the stuff that's commonly ignored in these stories. I think there's just so much weirdness that's being left out in order to sort of make this stuff comport to a physical real world. And, as skeptics, we say, well, hey, these stories, they've got a lot of holes in them, But I mean, that doesn't even cover it. There's so much more going on here than just the sort of light skeptical treatment. There's a lot of straight up bizarre, quasi supernatural, paranormal adjacent, if not pure paranormal stuff going on here. It's weird. And it's the kind of stuff I think our listeners will enjoy reading, but I think it's also like it's kind of an indictment against the field that I think that in their efforts to sort of get that sort of scientific endorsement, they're leaving out huge swaths of the actual case files. So
I would agree. I would agree. I think, you know, that we need to talk about all of it.
Which brings us to, I guess, the question everybody in our audience is wondering. Guys, what's your favorite monster?
Go ahead, Josh.
I'm gonna be a complete hipster here and mention something that I never talk about, that nobody I feel like ever talks about, and that's the Nandy Bear.
What?
Go on.
I really like the Nandy Bear. It's this East African creature that has been seen. It exists in not only in folklore of the region, but also, you know, there have been explorers, quote unquote, who have seen it, and it's by varying description, it's like this African bear, but Africa doesn't have bears. Other descriptions, it looks like a hyena, so like a bear hyena hybrid, and people have suspected that it might be a relict herbivore, or like a relict, you know, giant. There's these things called, I think they're called chelicotheres or something like that. Anyway, I've really found the Nandy Bear interesting because nobody talks about it. And it sounds like I just pulled that out of my butt.
Chelicothere movie.
Yeah, that thing, yeah.
I think that was in response to us saying earlier that we've heard it all.
Fair enough. Yeah, I guess so. I thought he was sneezing, so.
Science, but I'm sorry, bless you. What? That's what, yeah, my family sneezes, we yell science.
It's one of those cryptids though that might stand a good chance of being proven as being an actual animal. It's not a weirdo cryptid, but I've always really thought that was a really interesting idea because again, people never hear about it. So I'm like,
no, yeah, I don't think we've ever talked about it on the show. I have heard of
it
before.
So. We have to now.
Yeah, absolutely, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. The Nandy Bear. Timothy, your turn.
Tim doesn't know who I am anymore.
Josh's next book is all about the Nandy Bear, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Bigfoot, but a very specific kind of Bigfoot. And my favorite Bigfoot cases, and you know, a lot of guys into Bigfoot, they collect, you know, Bigfoot toys and Bigfoot figures and stuff. And I do too, but only of this very specific kind. So I don't care about brown Bigfoot. I don't care about black Bigfoot. I don't care about any other Bigfoot but green Bigfoot. I love green Bigfoot. I love green Bigfoot stories. I collected one myself, a local guy in an area called Toad Road. It's right about it, my first book, and in Don't Look Behind You Again. There was one in the aforementioned Two Brothers case that we talked about in Sasquatch Chronicles. One of the creatures they saw, they said, was green.
I just noticed that green Bigfoot is also a chronic strain. That's interesting.
Nice. And,
it sounds like Christmas Bigfoot.
Yeah. And
Christmas tree.
There's a case you talk about, you know, the strangeness being, you know, cut away from these cases or sanded off. There's a case called Fluorescent Freddy. And in all the that was written about it, you would read about this big hairy creature that people were seeing in the 1950s in, I think it was Indiana. And they'd say, oh, yeah, they called him Fluorescent Freddy because he had red or orange glowing eyes, depending on who you read about it. Well, I dug in and I found the original newspaper reports and he was called Fluorescent Freddy. Yes, he did have red or orange glowing eyes, but he had green fur. And that's why they were green hair. And that's why they called him, the kids in the neighborhood called him Fluorescent Freddy, because he had bright green hair. So I love green Bigfoot. And those are the only sort of Bigfoot ephemera kind of things I actually call
it. That sounds so much like the Green Man from England.
Sure. Yeah.
I have a friend who's, you know, there's a whole bunch of Green Man pubs. And they actually have like a Green Man Pub Association for all the people who own a Green Man Pub. And so one of my friends here in Georgia has set up a British pub in his basement. He's from England, and he's got this beautiful Green Man pub, and he's got the Green Man logo all over the place. He set up giant megaliths in his backyard. It's so cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Well, they both proved us wrong anyway with their answers.
Oh, no, this is good stuff. I hadn't, you know, these are great. We've never had these before. These are great. Well, guys, thank you so much for making time for us today. And we will put links to your books in our show notes. And I think our listeners will really get a kick out of reading your work. And
thanks so much.
I noticed in one of your interviews you hinted that you'd be doing an Audible version. Have you guys done any work on that yet?
We have to figure out what form it's going to take. We had a company reach out to us, but that didn't work out. So, at some point there should be an audio version, but we'll figure it out.
Well, I hope you do. When you do, please let me know, especially if it's on Audible, because I'll be snatching that up.
Will do.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You've been listening to an interview with Timothy Renner and Joshua Kutchin, talking about their two-volume look at Bigfoot stories that are weirder than what you're probably used to. Where are the Footprints In, Volume 1, The Folklore, and Volume 2, The Evidence. A link to these and the other books we mentioned in this episode will be in the show notes. Reading all these strange, quasi-paranormal Bigfoot reports doesn't make me any more inclined to believe in the reality of these animals, but it continues to fascinate me and makes me think that there's a lot about the human mind and the way we experience the world that we still don't understand scientifically. Will we ever? I don't know. But pretending that such reports don't happen certainly moves us no further towards understanding the phenomena and the many overlapping fields that comprise monsterology. Hey, Monster Talkers, we'll be doing a live Monster Talk this Sunday night, April 4th, 2021 at 8 p.m. Eastern. I think that will be found at youtube.com/monstertalk, but be sure and check our Monster Talk Facebook page or our feed at patreon.com/monstertalk for the latest information on that. This week we're going to be discussing two really interesting vampire cases, and it should be a lot of fun. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. As always, thank you so much for listening and for your support.
Been a Monster House presentation.